This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Bella. Bella, this is Mr. McCandles.
Hello, Bella.
Oh, she's an experiment.
Good evening.
Her brain and her body are not quite synchronized. But she's progressing at an accelerated pace.
Tell me, where did she come from?
I shall. For it is a happy tale.
I am Bella Baxter, and there is a world to enjoy, circumnavigate. It is the goal of all to progress, grow.
A woman plotting her course to freedom. How delightful.
Hello, Tobias.
Do you want to start with the intro bit?
Well, I don't remember the word. There's no Giles.
Wait, I can do. I've listened to that hundreds of times.
Okay.
And action!
Hello and welcome to episode 389 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we learn
filmmaking
from indie film to studio film to
high-end TV and everything in between.
How to make them, how to try not to
F them up in our very humble opinion.
I think I forgot something there.
Close enough.
Yes, it's close enough.
It's Giles' fault for being off in Bulgaria, so... any complaints can be directed to the Giles Alderson mailbox for intro complaints on the Filmmakers Podcast. So there we go. So welcome to the Filmmakers Podcast.
There you go. Who are you? Who am I talking to?
Dom Lenoir.
And I'm Tobias Fees. I'm a writer-director.
You are?
I am. And...
I'm obviously the same thing. This is our first intro together. Giles is off in Bulgaria. He's doing a concept shoot. He's got some big fancy cranes and other such things, which is very exciting. He's there with Andrew Beard Rogers, as he's known, the cinematographer, having a lovely time. I have just come back from Scotland, where I was producing another concept film, which was all very exciting because doing a film in another country has a whole bunch of logistical things you've got to figure out. You've got to figure out how the crews work. You've got to figure out the infrastructure. You've got to figure out, you know, how the prices differ for things like accommodation, kit costs, crew, cast, what people are sort of up for doing and not up for doing. There's a whole bunch of sort of considerations that certainly make it quite a challenge. But we had a really successful shoot up in Aberfoyle and Perth and with director Moran Huck. And some great actors over from France and also London. So we shot in castles and a cow-themed cafe, which had a giant cow on top. So that's me. What have you been up to, Tobias? What have you been up to?
Mainly writing at the moment. I'm writing with Giles, a couple of stuff. before I went down to Bulgaria, and currently also writing with a good friend of mine, Stefan Zeiler, on a mystery horror show. And we are about to go around and pitch that show in UK and Germany in the next few weeks. So exciting prospects. And while Charles away, I have the honor to edit the podcast again, which is very lovely. It's nice to be back.
Poor soul.
Yeah, I'm a poor thing.
Yeah, you are a poor thing, which is you're doing my job on the puns, which links us to this episode, which is with the very impressive producers from Element Picture, which is Ed Gainey
and Andrew Lowe. Some of their credits include The Wonder, Normal People, The Nest, The Favorite, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, Room, The Lobster. I think with The Lobster, their collaboration with Yorgos Lanthimos started, right?
Yeah.
What can our audience learn from this week's episode, Tom? What did you guys talk about?
Working with Yorgos Lanthimos over the years, quite a few years actually, collaborating with brand new filmmakers, raising finance for dramas, and how to give creative notes.
I already edited the podcast, so I can give you some insights as well. You'll also learn about the importance of festival and audience reactions, tips and tricks for up-and-comers, and managing a successful production company.
There we go. Fantastic. Something you sort of covered in our preamble to the preamble was that the it was a really good chat in that it was very down to earth, and it wasn't sort of about the buzz of working with, you know, big time directors and massive actors. It was actually just a chat about making films, which I think is very much why I enjoyed this chat as well. We don't always get to chat to sort of development executives as well, so that was kind of fascinating, and you know, to see how they select projects and how they position them in the marketplace, and all of the challenges around that.
Yeah, what challenges they have to overcome as well. Like when you talk that casually about a project of that scale, it suddenly takes off the magical aura a little bit of this Oscar-winning feature film, and suddenly it's a conversation about making a film, and they talk about the same challenges you and me overcome in making films. Obviously in a higher scale. So that was really interesting to hear, and also very inspiring.
So settle down, get those ears ready, and
enjoy.
Very much honest.
Thirsty work, isn't it?
It is indeed.
How are you feeling about the release?
How's everything going for Paul Vings? Really happy with it. I mean, you know, slightly forced by circumstance with the actor strike and everything, the film is released now as opposed to, you know, earlier last year when initially we planned to go out, and it's worked, you know, it's so happily it's coincided with awards attention, which is brilliant. So I mean, it's doing really well in the US and doing really well here as well, which is really gratifying to see. I was struck there was a Lifetime sort of retrospective career interview that Yorgos did yesterday for the BFI.
Oh, brilliant.
And it was clear everyone in the room had seen the film, and one woman put up her hands to ask a question, and she told Yorgos she'd seen the film 6 times.
Wow.
She was planning to see it again. That's
a good indicator.
Hardcore. Yeah,
that's a very good indicator.
So, and actually there's quite anecdotally quite a lot of people going to see it a second time because there's so much in it. It's such a rich, you know, kind of the design and, you know, costume. There's so much detail in it, and it's so layered that people I think are you know, enjoying seeing it more than once.
I went to the I think it was one of the BAFTA screenings in Leicester Square, and they all of the cast and crew and everyone walked out at the end of it, and there was these hushed discussions. Jude Law was in the audience. He looked like he was thinking about it. I mean, was just having a real thought about the, you know, so it's a real thought-provoking film, and you know, from my perspective, it's definitely the one that's been most discussed out of all of the award season. So you know, I guess it's doing well in that sense.
No, it's brilliant.
Like with a film like this, or not like this, with this film specifically, we didn't really know how it would land and how it would be received. I mean, it's a big swing. It's very unusual. It's sort of you know, very much its own thing, and kind of hard to find precedents that you can point to and say, well, this worked or that worked or whatever. So before it played at Venice, where when the Golden Lion, we were, you know, we were anxious about how it would go out. And also because at that point, because of the SAG strikes, we didn't have Emma kind of to stand alongside the film. And she's obviously such an important...
A huge part, yeah.
Yeah, not only as Bella, but also as one of the producers, one of the people who's been very involved in shaping the film. And so we sort of felt like a bit, potentially a bit vulnerable not having her with us. But, you know, it went out well, and I guess the different phases, you know, there's kind of the initial critical response and festival response is the first thing, which, you know, certainly in Europe and then the US, a Telluride worked. And then it's sort of how the film sits in the culture as it begins to encounter kind of audiences. Even before it's released, you kind of get a sense of how the film is being thought about and talked about.
Yeah, and consumed in the critics as well.
Exactly that, precisely that. And then it's, you know, cinema owners beginning to see it as all that kind of stuff. And then it's the audience is the next big moment. And it's done, you know, as Andrew was saying earlier, it's done well, which is great. And then the awards as the kind of final thing, which, and it is a kind of, you know, certainly in our case, not always the case, but it's a sort of virtuous circle, you know. The critics help the awards really help the audience.
Yeah.
And particularly with a film like this. I mean, for some movies, arguably, Oppenheimer or Barbie, who've been out in the world and done incredibly well already.
Yeah.
The awards are a great recognition, but for us, they really power the business side of it.
Is that always the consideration? Because you do make sometimes quite hard to make films, I guess. And the festival circuit, is that always in the sort of the strategy right from the word go?
Yeah, I mean, I think festivals are critical and more so now, arguably, than ever as a launchpad for a film. And it's just, you know, festivals like Venice and Cannes are unique opportunities where you've got the world's media gathered in one place, and you know, you can bring all your talent in and you just maximize the impact. And you know, there's really nothing like it, certainly for the sort of films that we do. So it's always a key consideration, where do you launch the film?
What was your experience of the actors strike, the writers strike, for, you know, from an English sort of company perspective? Because I mean, a lot of people have especially in the crew world, have really struggled over here. I mean, I know it's a universal thing. What's your experience sort of coming out the other side of that, just before we get back to the film?
I mean, I guess, you know, there's a couple of things. I mean, because we're, you know, UK Irish company, and a lot of the talent we work with are local, we weren't directly impacted by the writer strike necessarily, because we don't often work with WGA writers. We were affected by the SAG strike, practically speaking from Poor Things' point of view, because none of our cast could promote the film, and that had a bearing on the decisions around when it got released. And also it did, you know, it did affect decisions about going into production on new films, just because even people who weren't directly affected by the strike were sort of uncomfortable with working in it during the strike period.
Yeah. There was this kind of apprehension around the whole thing, wasn't there?
Yeah. So it was a very unwelcome, you know, interlude, and we totally understood and empathized with the people who were caught up in it as to why they were on strike. But, you know, arguably you should never have been allowed to get that far, and it's great that they got resolved. But it's, you know, there's no doubt about it. It's such a complex business. Something as crude as a strike that just stops everything, it's very damaging, and it takes a very long time to actually fully understand the implications of that. And I suspect it'll take us a while yet before we fully do. But obviously, for individual crews, particularly tough.
Yeah, because it feels like there's been a little bit of a delay in terms of, I think some people in the independent world thought, okay, strikes are over, we're back to it, we're going to get our cast, we're going to get our films greenlit, and it doesn't seem to be quite the case. It seems to be a slightly slower process, but...
I think the market is sluggish, you know, cinemas haven't quite recovered, you know, from the kind of blow of the pandemic, and obviously you're just seeing all of these huge corporations retrenching in terms of spend and all that. The thing that's kind of sort of frustrating about it, though, is that, and I mean, we have this experience because we own theatres in Ireland, a 4-screen art house cinema in Dublin and a 3-screen art house cinema in Galway. And actually, there is a sense that the audience really are up for it and open to it. And, you know, we had a great weekend in the Lighthouse with, among others, Zone, All of Us Strangers, Poor Things, Holdovers, I'm missing one or two there.
Great films, Adam of the Fall, Priscilla, The Boy and the Heron. I mean, they're all playing really, you know, really well. And, really performing
but
well.
It's this kind of weird thing that, like, actually audiences want them, but they're not being served. I mean, there's a glut now. And that's not just to do with the strike. I think, in a way, there's a kind of an innate conservatism has crept into decision-making, both in film and television, in the big studios. And I mean, there are obvious exceptions, like our friends at Searchlight and A24, and there are exceptions, you know, people who are...
they're taking more chances.
Yeah, but by and large, it's very conservative. I think, you know, if you look at the output of the major studios, it's all remakes, spin-offs, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of the things that we're hopeful about and maybe optimistic about is that, you know, obviously Barbenheimer is a huge moment because you know, despite what they say about Barbie, it isn't really based on IP. It is an original story, you know. And whether you love it or you don't, it's still a thing. You have to recognize that, and a very welcome thing. Same with Oppenheimer in a completely different way, but also Poor Things, also the movies this year. But also if you go back a couple of years, Everything Everywhere, Parasite, maybe even The Joker, maybe The Favourite. So films that are kind of breaking the mold, going elsewhere, telling different stories. It feels like there's an appetite there in the audience, with the audience, but we're not serving it.
Yeah.
And that would make us optimistic, because that's obviously a hole that we'd like to fill.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I love watching, and, you know, I think a lot of our audience love making is those kind of interesting stories that aren't a rehash of something. They're something completely unique. So so talking of unique, let's talk about how Poor Things began, what that kind of very first inception was. Did this come to you from Yorgos? Was this an internal? How does the ball start rolling in this kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was brought to us by Yorgos. It was a book he read sort of, you know, 2011, 12, sometime around then. He loved the book, was amazed to find it hadn't been adapted, reached out to Alistair Gray, and ended up spending an interesting evening wandering around Glasgow with Alistair, at the end of which he gave him his permission to go ahead and adapt the book. So we in the meantime connected with Yorgos actually over The Favourite. So he was doing the rounds here in London, having had success with Dogtooth, and decided his next film he wanted it to be in the English language. And so we initially attached him to what was then Balance of Power, which became The Favourite, but that had a long development history. So whilst we were waiting for that to kind of be ready, he pitched us the idea of The Lobster. And we loved that and commissioned him, FD Music, to go off and write that.
And that was the first one you did together.
Yeah. So that was the first one we actually made together. Mm. But Poor Things was the thing then. And it took a while. I mean, it sort of took shape. I think we optioned it. It was maybe 2015 or something. And formally, then Tony at that stage was well into rewriting The Favourite. And so Yorgos asked him to take a look at the book. And once we were into production on The Favourite, Yorgos became very clear that Emma was someone he wanted to work with closely in the future. They had a great working relationship. He mentioned, he kind of ran through his slate with her, I guess, during production of The Favourite, and she really responded to Poor Things. And it's interesting, he was talking about this last night, that it wasn't necessarily obvious to him that that should be the next thing, but given her response to it, he felt, actually, let's try and do that. So it was a long gestation, but actually came together quite quickly in the end.
Well, it sounds like there's a long gestation period for all the projects, which is great for good storytelling, because I think a lot of people try and rush out their scripts and their films, and there's plot holes, and there's not the depth that you need. And the development process is incredibly important, it seems, to your company. How does that start once he's kind of done his adaption, the first draft of the screenplay, what's then your note-taking process? How does it work within the company for all of you?
I mean, he's quite sort of self-sufficient, Yorgos. He tends to work, I mean, like with either, I mean, the writers he's been working with, Efthymis and Tony, on different projects. But, you know, he tends to work very closely with them. And we over the years, we may have seen a treatment or an outline. And then if we're moving forward with it, then we'll see quite an evolved script. So it's sort of like it's unlike many other people we work with, where you get stuff that's really quite thought through and quite well honed. So there isn't really a big process of kind of head scratching and note giving and note taking and all that stuff. It's very, I mean, we probably have about four or five things with Yorgos and at different stages, different writers. And it's sort of, it's kind of, he's very good at pushing them along. And then it's never entirely clear which one will be next. But, you know, as Andrew's saying, Emma's enthusiasm for Poor Things elevated that. And the fact that, I suppose, the stars aligned in terms of, you know, it coming at the back of The Favourite, which had done well awards-wise and box office-wise, which meant that we could make the argument for Poor Things. But there's also like bits of serendipity involved in it. You know, I think that it was a good moment to try and get that made.
Let's take Yorgos out of the equation for a moment. What would your usual process be for if you've agreed to join a project and, you know, the development process, because it's a thing that people want to know how would you approach a company like you? What would you be interested in, and what sort of things would you be looking for?
I mean, we do a lot of repeat business with people.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, obviously Yorgos is very well known. We also continue to work with Joanna Hogg and Lenny Abrahamson, Sebastian Lelio, like a whole, and actually a lot of, you know, Paddy Brannock, an Irish filmmaker.
Yeah.
There's also, like, in Element, there's kind of Andrew and I, but then there's another five producers, all of whom have their own relationships and are doing their own thing. And so like, in a sense, it's about people's personal taste and conviction, and whether that's for a book or a filmmaker or a writer or whatever, it sort of doesn't necessarily matter where something comes from. I think we tend to gravitate towards more established talent now, although having said that, we're in a wave of doing three or four first-time films right at this moment in time.
Wow.
But it's really about the kind of talent relationships. And I think one of the things about us as a company is that we as a production company, I think our skill, if you like, is being able to sort of bend our processes and the way we work around how a filmmaker wants to work. So I don't think there's an element house style and you come and you fit into that. I think it's really about us kind of finding the best way to work with a Joanna or a Lenny or a Yorgos indeed. And they all require different things. Some people like to spend days, in fact, weeks, in fact, months talking about things in great detail with a lot of the team. And other people like Yorgos are quite sort of self-sufficient and get on with it and sort of indicate to us what they want to do.
I mean, I think just to add to what Ed is saying, it's true there isn't like a house style, but I suppose one of the kind of guiding principles we operate on for development is that insofar as possible, we try and keep the process very self-contained, so that actually it's really just us and the writer and the director, hopefully by and large, with maybe a sympathetic partner. So, you know, we've developed a lot with Film 4 over the years, particularly with Yorgos. We've also worked very closely with BBC Film. We've a close working relationship with A24. So there are, you know, and obviously with Searchlight. And so, you know, as much as possible, what we try and do is develop the script and keep it under wraps and wait until such time as we're happy it's ready to go. And at that point, we go out to the market and say, this is what it is, and this is what we're doing with it. And the principle is we're trying to find like-minded partners to make something. We're not going out seeking permission to make it. So it's just an important kind of sort of mindset in a way, because it is just really tough to get anything made, as you know.
Yeah. I mean, that malleability sounds really refreshing, I think, from a filmmaking perspective, because, you know, you do hear stories of people going to, you know, looking for money and doing co-productions, and it's then pushed in a direction where it's not necessarily what you originally signed up for. And it sounds like you very much work around the filmmakers, which is fantastic. I mean, is it as important that kind of relationship with the people you're working with as the work itself? I mean, like how, you know, people's attitudes, that kind of thing.
You mean which is more important, the relationship the work itself?
Yeah, I mean, it's as important for both. I would imagine.
I mean, I think it's actually in a sense, I think we're more person focused than we are project focused.
Yeah. Mm.
So I don't think we go around saying we want to do whatever, an action thriller, or like, we never would say that.
Yeah, sure.
It's really responding to an individual creator and what they're interested in doing. It really is just that. Yeah. So if it was someone who came along and they had a great take on a horror movie, we do a horror movie, but we're not going out to agents saying we really want to do a horror movie.
Yeah,
if that
definitely
makes sense.
Yeah.
And so a lot of time, the alchemy is around, you know, meeting someone whose work you really admire. Well, first of all, seeing the work, then spending time with them, getting to know them a little bit, and then maybe finding a book that you think they might be interested in and sharing that book with them. Mm. And then, you know, very often they mightn't pick up on the book, but it does push the conversation on further. And then maybe they come to you with a script or whatever. So it's sort of like almost all of us in the company are film fans first and foremost. So that sort
that
of
definitely helps,
we come from that perspective. And we also very much see ourselves in, whether you want to call it specialty, smart house, prestige, independent, whatever, art, we're in that patch.
Yeah.
And I think we wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't chase a piece of IP that felt like it was a kind of tentpole movie without seeing it through the perspective or prism of a creator. If someone came to us with something, we'd love it. But we're not in that.
That camp,
that game. No.
No. I think that's also quite refreshing to hear. I mean, I think a lot of people expect that they will send a script, it will get picked up, their movie will get made. And what you were saying seems much more in line with, you know, experiences we've had, which is that actually these relationships take a long time. Sometimes you're not actually making a film with someone that you've met or you've discussed and you sort of resonate with for 3 or 5 years after the fact. Because I suppose, you know, for you to put your name to something, you have to be very sure that you're aligned and that the relationship's building at a sort of a steady pace rather than like, let's rocket fire this new person into a movie.
Yeah. I mean, even as Ed said, it just so happens, and it's not necessarily typical, but we are in the process of getting a number of debut films off the ground at the moment. But they've all been years in the making, you know, so sure. And there are relationships that have gestated over a period of time. And, you know, they are typically with one of the other producers in the company. Mm. Who've had their own individual relationship with those filmmakers. And it just so happens that they all happen to coincide around now. But that is the thing. I mean, you know, for someone who's aspiring and wants to kind of get their first film made, that's the key thing, is you got to find your relationships. And in some ways, you know, it's probably better to focus on people who are around you or in your orbit who are like-minded and want to do similar things and figure it out together. And, you know, maybe you make a short before you make your feature, and, you know, and that's, and by being out there and doing things, you're building those relationships, and really that's how you learn. And then that can, you know, that can elevate you. Once you've got something to show, then you can sort of leapfrog maybe and, you know, do bigger things quite quickly, but you've got to start somewhere, and that's usually the best place to start.
Yeah, and some kind of impressive, you know, showreel or portfolio, I suppose, is quite important. So just briefly talking about the sort of new wave of filmmakers, because that is a fair amount of our audience. What sort of things might they have done in generic? Are we talking like a award-winning short or that kind of thing? Probably this is their first feature?
Yeah.
Okay. All of them, all of the three first, and we can't really talk about them because they're not announced. So that's
completely,
slightly boring.
Completely vague,
but it's fine. Mysterious.
But all of them are, all of the people whose films we were making have all made great award-winning short films.
Yeah, sure.
Which isn't, you know, it isn't to say that that's like that you have to do an amazing short film in order to get to make a feature film. You don't. Like, if you have a different, you're coming at it from a different perspective, if you're an actor making a film, or if you're, you know, playwright or theater director or whatever, like there's lots of ways in, but a really great short is a really compelling way in. It just so happens that all of them are very, very different, but they're all films that would have done well at Sundance or festivals or, you know, being at Cannes or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I see quite a few people make shorts and they think, okay, well, what have we got available to us? We've got a room, we've got a few friends, we can do something like quite, you know, contained. But the ones that obviously do very well a lot of the time are unique voices and they're quite ambitious, and whether they succeed or not, it's about showing something that's unique, and I suppose that's what's going to impress people.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, it's just anecdotal, but Molly Manning-Walker, who made Out of Sex, which is just brilliant film and one of the best debuts in years. But I recently, or not, probably about 6 months ago, went back and looked at some of her short films, which are on her website. So very easy to watch. And they're really that. They're people in a room talking.
Okay, but done well.
Really well.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's the hardest thing to do is two people in a room.
That's true, yeah.
You know, talking about something that's important to them or the story, you know, excavating whatever story exists between the two of them. It's incredibly hard to do well.
Yeah.
And when you see it done well, it really pops. And I think it, you know, for you know, people who are kind of thinking about how do you make something that really impresses, I think sometimes it's the quiet, small thing. You know, it's the, you know, doesn't need lots of money spent on camera and all that kind of stuff. If you can fascinate an audience in two characters or three characters in an interesting space doing interesting things with each other, you know, together, then that's really impressive. And they're really worth watching, those films, because you just go, wow.
Yeah.
Like, why, how does this person just know how to interest us?
Yeah. You
know, she just does.
Kind of capturing that human experience. That's great. So let's go back to Yorgos and Poor Things. So we've got to the stage of the script being in a pretty good shape. You've been sent the script. You've had a bit of your feedback. What's next in terms of that going from script to casting, finance, working with Searchlight, those kind of considerations?
I mean, I think, you know, it started a little bit with casting, in the sense that obviously we had the script, and once Emma had announced her interest, that sort of elevated and pushed us in front of the queue. And one of the great things about that engagement was it was very clear Emma wasn't just interested in being in the film. She's just interested in everything about the film, how we're going to make it, and, you know, and so she sort of put her hand up to produce it alongside us, and we were delighted to have her.
That was Yorgos sort of reaching out to her agent, or
to her.
Because
mean, on the back of The Favourite, it was they'd become friends as well as colleagues, I think just creatively they've just a great charisma between them, so definitely. It was a kind of a natural conversation. And then we've developed all Yorgos's films with Film 4. And including Poor Things. So we figured then what we next needed to do was try and figure out the world a bit, you know, because it's such an ambitious world on the page. And Yorgos had
big set design budgets.
Yeah. So he had come across Sean Naheed's work through photography. She works called Tim Walker. And there was an exhibition they had in, I think it was the V&A, where they met. And that was, so Yorgos kind of sort of suggests she could be interesting, and Kasia Maliban, who was our co-producer on the film, had the bright idea of combining her with James Price. And James is a designer we'd worked with Kasia on The Nest, Sean Durkin's movie, and James has a lot of art directing experience by way of background, so he's very good on practical things, and as well as having a great flair for design. So we combined Sean and James, and both their teams came together and set up a concepting workshop for about 2 months in London. And that sort of coincided with, I get a bit hazy in the dates, but COVID had started, I think, at that stage, and had pushed our potential shoot dates back anyway, because nothing was happening for the first 6 months. So they were working away doing this. And it was a great period, because it was really when a lot of the world building was done. And so they figured out how we were actually going to realize this world. It was sort of a luxury, and Film 4 were great. They stepped up and said, that's fine, we'll do it. And they paid for it. And it just meant once we came out the other side of that, we had a much clearer idea of what we needed. It was clear we would need a lot of sound stages. And so then there's a whole exercise about, well, where do we find them? And we landed in Hungary ultimately because A, the crafts are really high standard there, and B, they had sound stage, including Korda, which is the largest stage in continental Europe where we built Lisbon.
Are there reasonable tax credits in Hungary now?
Yes. Yeah, there are. Yeah, it's a decent tax credit.
It's quite an unknown and untapped sort of tax credit, but that's always useful for.
Yeah, but it's become, I mean, Hungary has really managed to establish itself as a production location in the last couple of years. So the quite a lot of big TV shows and films have gone there to shoot. And so it's a well-oiled machine, if you like. There are other territories that have tax credits. You're never quite sure, will it be what you understand it to be by the end of it? But in case of Hungary, it's pretty straightforward. And that was, so alongside that that work and those conversations, we started Searchlight Conversation, which was sort of a natural evolution of our favorite experience. So we were all working together for the first time, Yorgos and us, with Searchlight, and Film 4 were part of the financing on The Favorite as well, obviously. So Searchlight made clear that they were very keen to continue the conversation on Yorgos's next film. And at the time, we weren't quite sure what it was going to cost. So we sort of came up with a number and then sort of went working on it. And it, by the time we knew everything about how we were going to make the film, the number had gone up a little bit, but not too much. And Searchlight and Film 4, in their wisdom, agreed to sign off, and the rest is history. So off we went and shot the film then.
Do you have considerations? Because another thing that people seem tend to look at just the tax credits, but they don't look at then the crew costs and what the infrastructure was like. Was that something that was, I mean, are there, what's that like in Hungary for people that are considering it?
Good. I mean, sorry, you can jump in, but we brought in all our heads of department from the, so it's mainly a British film in that sense, that they're mainly British heads of department, Robbie Ryan, the Irish DOP, but, and Hungary works really well if you can do that, you know, so there were really good sort of, if not seconds, thirds, you know, in each department, and all the crew thereafter were Hungarian.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they are an experienced crew, particularly around construction. We had a huge construction crew, as you can imagine, because pretty much everything in the film is shot, is built. So that was all Hungarian with our, you know, British-led art department. So it works on that level, but only by bringing in key HODs.
Yeah, sure.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale! Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
So what was some of the next steps in terms of just that collaboration with Film 4 and Searchlight? So you've got Emma on board, you've started the production design, you've started some of the set builds in Hungary. At that point, are you sort of fully financed in effect, and you're budgeted?
I mean, you don't start building until you're financed.
Yeah.
So script plus Emma.
Yeah.
Is kind of green, it's a lit. Great start.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Not green lit, but no. Kind of positive vibes to make a film at a certain number.
Sure.
And then the next phase is, as Andrew said, you're doing the production design in order to inform the budget.
Yes, okay.
But the budget is fungible depending on where you do it. So then, as Andrew mentioned, Kasia Malapan, who's our co-producer, line producer. So Kasia and Paula Heffernan, who's our head of production at Element, and other of the Element production team, they basically start to look at, you know, different models. So Hungary, UK, South Africa, you know, there's any number of places where you would go and say, well, can we get a budget? Mm. How many sound stages are available? How busy is the place? What's the crew in for? There are all these different kind of
models that are
Possibilities. So you have to run all of those, the different tax credits, all that kind of stuff. And at the end of all of that, you kind of go, okay, well, this is the place we should go. And it was Hungary in this case, because there were 6 sound stages available, because it's a really good crew base. It's a good tax credit, good crew, and actually, in terms of the cost of labor, way lower than, say, here in the UK. But also at that time, a lot of the UK studio space wasn't available because there was so many other Star Wars and Marvel and all that kind of stuff.
They've kind of taken over the main three, haven't they?
Yeah.
So you're doing that. Then you sort of get to a number and you're financed, and that's the point at which you then start building sets, et cetera.
Just to talk about that number, Emma's obviously got a value. What was the sort of the next conversations in terms of what other cast you were expecting to kind of make that justifiable budget?
I mean, it wasn't really a thing.
No.
I think was it just add people because they...
Emma was the precondition, if you like. I think once we had Emma, everything else was like a bonus, but not a requirement, if you like. So at the point that we, as Ed described, it's not like there's a green light meeting. So there's one day you're green lit. It's kind of, it's an evolution, really. And I think the point at which it was clear we were green lit or as good as green lit, I'm not sure we had
mark attached at that point. So it was really just about Emma, and it was Yorgos and Emma. And once that's agreed, then
that's
rest.
Enough of a brand for the rest.
But also, like, we've long standing relationship. I mean, we know the people. We've made, I don't know, more than 10 movies we'd film for.
Yeah.
We were making another film with Searchlight at the same time, and so like you know, there is, as Andrew said, there's no like, okay, now you're greenlit. They're, what they say to you is, look, if you can get to this sort of number, we're good, and there'll be a bit of toing and froing around the exact number, but you're generally in a zone.
Yeah.
And then the other great thing about Yorgos as a filmmaker is that he is genuinely interested in actors who have made a real impression on the world.
Mm.
And he has he's a great consumer of film and TV. He's seen absolutely everything. So he knows who he's interested in. And very often they're the kind of people that the studios also love as well. So that's never a thing for us. That's never a conversation. Now, it is often a big conversation with other filmmakers where they're like, I want to cast an unknown and, you know, in the lead. And that's not going to work with something like Poor Things. The economics of it are never going to work. But Yorgos never compromises in casting, but he's also very interested in people who are, you know, making an impression. And I guess if you think, like, obviously Ruffalo and Willem Dafoe are incredibly well known, but actually the innovation with Ruffalo is asking him to play a part like this because he's never played something like this before. That's the kind of clever thing that Yorgos brings to it. Or indeed Rami Yusuf, who would ever think that Rami Yusuf would play a sort of a kind of young English doctor. And that kind of joining of those dots. And it just makes it like a very interesting ensemble.
Yeah.
And kind of seeing people do things, even if they're well known, that they haven't done before.
Yeah, people love seeing that. Like, they really do. Like, as soon as you see an actor go against type, it's fascinating to an audience.
Yeah.
But it's a high wire act again, you know. It's like and Mark's spoken about this a lot, but I mean, for Mark to have the confidence to do what he did playing Duncan, you need to really trust the director because you're way out in a limb there.
Yeah.
And you could be left swinging. If that's not mixing my metaphors, which it is, but you know what I mean.
So I guess at that point, Emma and Yorgos and the overall package is what it is, and the budget just slightly inflates with other actors, but then that also inflates how much you can sell it for and the back end and the audience numbers, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not scientific.
No, of course not. No,
it's not. But it is. It's a bit like a jigsaw in a way, putting the cast together in terms of the commercial side of it, because you've got to figure out there's only a fixed pot of money and there's only a specific amount of back end to be shared out amongst everyone, and then deciding the priority of that and who gets what is it's a negotiation ultimately, but it's a bit of a parlor game, but you always get there and takes a while.
It's a really significant stage, I suppose, isn't it? It's when you have a notion of how much money you can get to make it, you have a notion of the costs, and also then you have to make everyone feel well looked after, well treated, everybody, and that's Andrew spends more time in the weeds on that than I do, but that's a very,
very important part.
It's a key. Like, you're not greenlit till all that stuff happens and those people are on board and the deals are done, and that's the moment at which you're greenlit, actually.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the production and also the post after that. Like, what do you like to do as producers and as a company for something like this once it's gone into, we've got the schedule you're about to shoot?
I mean, you kind of stay out of the way, ideally, like Kasia, who we mentioned earlier, Kasia and Yorgos are at the coalface of running the film day to day. Like, they're kind of, they're in a constant dialogue talking about stuff. Andrew and I would tend to be one step kind of back from there. And if there are issues that come up, things we can help with, issues to do with financiers, cast, et cetera, we're there to kind of help and make decisions. Sometimes decisions need to be made. But Yorgos is a really, he likes to kind of create a small set, you know, so even though we have very big sets on Poor Things, we were able to very often just close the door on the set and Yorgos and Robbie and Haley are first and sound and, you know, a small number of people with the cast on stage, which has worked through the day. He tends to more than make his days, you know, so it, once you're up and running, there are of course really stressful moments.
Yeah.
But actually he's a very, very well organized filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're just trying
to occasional sort of set visits.
But I mean, we're there, like one of us would always be there, yeah. But you know, because you never know when you're needed or when something pops, you know, that you need to deal with. And I think that's maybe not, maybe Yorgos doesn't care, but I think it may also be reassuring to him know that
you're there if you need you, but you're not like in the foreground all the time that there's my producer. Yeah.
No, and it, like, you know, and also actually by and large, certainly at the level that, you know, you work at with somebody like Yorgos, it's not conflictual. You know what I mean? We're doing our very best to give him what he needs to make the film.
Yeah.
And we're trying to organize things around the film, including like the deals and making sure everyone feels happy to be part of it. And so that actually everyone comes to it with the kind of most open-hearted, up for it, excited and wanting to work. And so it's really, our job is to maintain that environment and that kind of space for, and not, you know, to stay out of the way as long as that's working.
I mean, I think it's, you know, as what Ed is describing is almost a perfect kind of scenario from a producer's perspective where, you know, the time we can have most influence really is during pre-production and putting it together. Yeah. And those key decisions about where we make it, who we make it with, you know, the crew, the cast, all of that, and those deals and everything. Once it's up and running, hopefully it more or less takes care of itself. I'm being productive, but it's, you know, so long as it goes, okay. So in some ways, if you know, we've had the opposite experience where every day is miserable and you got to be there and you're in the trenches and it is miserable and it's tough, but hopefully that's not the case. And then it's really in post that you just kind of get to have a more impactful, you know, role again, because it's
back into the other flip side of the creative development side.
Exactly. And not only is the film coming together, but also the plans for its release are coming together and its launch into the world, and you know, that's an important thing for us to focus on and be part of those conversations to make sure everyone's happy with that. So in an ideal world, the production bit is the bit where we can afford to perhaps take a step back and let others just get on with it.
So let's talk about the post you just mentioned. I mean, how does that work with your company? You've got Searchlight, you've got Film 4, who maybe have an opinion, and Yorgos. Does he go off and do his first cut and then everyone sort of has a look, because it's, you know, there's lots of different things to manage at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit like the scripting thing in a way. Like he takes his time editing. Mm. He edits not always, but recently and probably into the future in Athens with Blackfish, who's his editor, has been for years. So it's very low key. It's very quiet. It's very considered. And when he feels like he's close, he'll share it. And, you know, the partners at that point, Searchlight and Film 4 and ourselves, would all have an opportunity to input and say what we think and what everyone thinks. And he takes that on board and he'll do another cut. And there'll be a number of cuts on that basis.
Yeah.
He's a final cut director. So at the end of the day, he is the one who arbitrates and says, well, actually, thank you for all of this, but this is where I feel I've landed and this is what I think the film is. And people are very respectful of that.
Yep.
If they disagree, they'll put up their hands and they'll say it, but ultimately they're very respectful of it. And certainly, again, in the world that we live in, we're not about making film or television by committee. Mm. We like an environment where people have, where the people involved intimately in making a film have a say and a seat at the table. But we also understand that to make really great work, someone's point of view has to sort of be reflected.
Yeah,
and some subjectivity has to be brought to bear, because it is a completely subjective business that we work in. So there's no right or wrong in a sense. Someone has to make a decision. So in a way, it's also just about enabling that as well, and making sure that Yorgos has enough time to finish the film and that the way that he wants to. And again, when you've worked with people like Film 4 and Searchlight, who are so good at doing this stuff and work with great filmmakers themselves, they're very, very sensitive to that and very supportive of it. And, you know, so it's not, you know, there is, again, that kind of thing where you feel like there must be great conflict and argy-bargy. And
yeah. Not if things are working well.
Not really. And even if they're not totally smooth, there's a lot of respect.
Yeah.
So that counts for a lot. It's not to say that it's a stress. It isn't. Like, it's very, it can be very stressful and worrying and challenging. But it's not, it's, in the best world, at least, everyone's moving in the same direction
it's,
together.
It's also, to go back to your repeat business point, I mean, these are people who we've made several films with at this stage. So there is just a shorthand there. And in some ways, you know, everyone sort of understands how this is going to play out because we've been here before. So that helps refine how people respond and engage.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it's a mutual thing as well. Mm. Like, you know, he's going to want to keep working with you, and if he's got a good relationship, and he likes people's ideas, he's going to be receptive to that. So it seems like it's a very mutual kind of setup.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, but also you don't take that for granted. Like, you also have to, you know, every time we work together, we, like, the next time you do, you try and do it better. And there are always problems and things you can learn from and go, well, that didn't work out so well. That might be the choice of a crew member, might be, you know, something that you could have thought about a bit more, you could have researched, you know, there's all that stuff. So you have to kind of try and make the next one a more kind of creatively pleasurable, rewarding experience and you know, for everyone.
Was there anything specifically on Poor Things that was, you know, quite challenging in terms of how to shoot it and, you know, from a producing... I mean, obviously all of it was incredibly complicated.
Well, the scale of it was really the thing. I mean, the sets are just enormous. I mean, Lisbon alone is like a city block, and it's three-story high buildings, and they're composite sets. So you walk up the stairs and you open a door and you're in a room and you open another. So they're really big. But, you know, as Ed alluded to earlier, Yorgos really likes keeping his sets small and intimate. So one of the challenges was building these sets but not having any lighting in the room. So what we did was a little unusual, but we actually put up a lighting rig, and then we put up a rig, and then we built sets so that the lights were up for, I don't know, 12 weeks or something as we built the sets and shot on them. And certainly from a practical production point of view, at one point we had to sit down with the lighting company and say, we're in trouble here. And of course, that meeting clarified that we had all the lights in Hungary and half the lights in Germany up. And, you know, and that was fine because we needed them. But at the same time, it was like, Jesus.
Then you have to find a solution. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we had to try and, you know, kind of adapt a little bit. So, but the light that allowed Yorgos shoot the film with the cast and maybe only with Robbie in the room, the DP, or, you know, possibly sound, but that was it. Nobody else had to be in the room, and that, you know, so that was particularly challenging given the scale of it. But with great people to work it out for us.
Yeah, fantastic. So just going on to the festival side of things. I mean, who's kind of taking the leads on that? Is that more the distribution? Is that kind of are you making like a campaign to? I mean, for major festivals, obviously everyone has very good track records, and that obviously takes a big part, but how does that sort of, at what stage, and how does that kind of come together?
It's sort of the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's a conversation. You know, it's about when the film is finished. It's about thinking, well, what, you know, where's the best place to launch this? It's about how responsive the festival is to the film. Do they get it? Do they feel like they're going to be supportive of it? Are they going to give it the right place? The other thing that's a sort of big dynamic around that is Yorgos is very keen on having input into the imagery around the film, the posters, and specifically the posters, but more generally than that, the kind of all the supporting marketing material. And he works with a great graphic designer, a friend of his in Athens, Vasilis Marmatakis, and he's done all of the posters for Yorgos's films. So he you know, would be working in recently, at least, with say Searchlight, looking at kind of the first images and all that kind of stuff. So that's also a big part of the conversation. But until the film goes out, I mean, I've sort of told this story before, but like, we genuinely didn't know. And I remember being in Venice and I was having coffee with a great young Australian Montenegrin filmmaker called Goran Stalevski. Do you know him at all? Do you know who he is? Anyway, we were just having coffee. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. I was aware, 11 o'clock in the morning, I was aware that the press and industry screening, which is the first time the press see the film, which is the morning of the official screening. So it's really the first audience for the film, was going on. I was very anxious and I had my phone beside me, and Rebecca Keary, who's the head of international for Searchlight, phoned and said, it's gone well. They like it. Right. And that And it's actually not until that and the subsequent things that you kind of can really start planning the distribution of the film.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, you need to know that it's well received in order to invest in its distribution. But if it had gone the other way, it would have been a very different conversation in terms of how much money people are prepared to spend or what the ambition for the film is.
Yeah.
But it's still a conversation.
I mean, I was just going to add to that. I mean, you know, in making our choice of distributor in the first instance, it's obviously we'd had a great experience with Searchlight on The Favourite, but part of the reasoning for being in business with Searchlight is because they have such a great pedigree in this sort of thing. So they have a great track record in terms of awards success with specialty films that we make. And so we are in their hands in a sense in terms of, you know, figuring out the strategy. So yes, we have a say in it and we have a view and we've our own experience, but we're very much guided by their expertise, if you like. So, you know, as to whether we go to Cannes or go to Venice and, you know, and obviously the decision as to when the film is released is led by them and we buy into that hopefully, you know, so, and they do have, you know, they have fantastic track record in that respect.
Yeah, they certainly do.
But it is the defining moment in the life of a film, which is self-evident and obvious, but actually people forget about it. It's when the audience see it.
Yeah.
It's when the rubber hits the road, and particularly for the kind of films that we make, because we're not in the business of making films that are kind of, you know, kind of can be, you know, that are marketing juggernauts that you can push through just by spend. We're making films that actually need to land with an audience. And I would say that, I mean, that's obviously the case for Poor Things. It's also the case for, like, I mean, there was an Irish film, a Northern Irish film called Kneecap, which played at Sundance this year.
Yeah. Jack Tulling?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, it sounds crazy and brilliant. Mm. And it won the audience prize at Sundance.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it's all about. Like, have you connected with an audience? And then there are possibilities for the thing. But if you don't connect with an audience, it's really hard.
Yes.
It's just really hard. But it is worth bearing in mind, no matter what the scale of thing is, if it lands with an audience, then everything is possible.
Everything can be.
If it doesn't, it's bloody difficult, and we've had that too.
Yeah. I mean, what do you do in that situation, Jay?
You know, you obviously try and give it its best day out, but you also try and understand, well, what part of the audience responds to it particularly? Is it going to play particularly well with, you know, this person or that person? I mean, in a way, you know, things that are like, you know, a small quiet drama can actually sort of hide in, it's maybe lack of connectivity can hide in plain sight for a long time. In other words, it can go to a lot of festivals and do quite well and get quite sort of good response. But unless something like that has really great kind of traction, it's very hard to put it out in cinemas.
I mean, so it's just on a small anecdote. It's also, you know, interesting sometimes what a difference time can make. So we launched The Lobster at Cannes, and it was very well received, and it picked up the, I was going to say jury screenplay, jury it was in the end, award. And, you know, we at the time, we had done Room with A24 and very close to them. Mm-hmm. We were trying to encourage them to put their hat in the ring and to buy the film for the US, but they were just a little bit unsure of it, and they just felt that maybe it was slightly too strange and whatever. So we had acquired the UK and Irish rights together with Picture House, and we put it out here in the UK and Ireland, did really well for an art house movie. It took like £1.5 million, and it went on to be released all around different territories around the world. And the US buyer who did buy it in Cannes went out of business a few months later, and so we brought it back into the market, and A24 did then pick it up, because at that stage it had been an established success elsewhere.
Yeah.
And so a year to the day after we brought it to Cannes, they released it in the US, and it opened really well, and it did incredibly well for them. So, you know, 12 months earlier, there was no question of that happening, but just because of the fluke of circumstance that, you know, we bought ourselves a bit of time, not deliberately, we found the right home, and it did really well. So,
So just going back to starting of the company and how you two kind of found your way, like what was your very, very redacted version of getting into the industry and creating sort of Element Picture and trying to make these kind of, you know, difficult to make but great drama films?
Well, we had slightly different routes in. I weirdly wanted to be a producer when I was very young, and I was friendly with Lenny Abrahamson, and when we both went to Trinity together in Dublin, and that as did Andrew, that was the university that's in Normal People, actually the same place. And we set up a filmmaking society together. And so that was really the beginning of making short films, et cetera, et cetera. And then I set up a company called Temple. We made a couple of films, but Andrew and I knew each other and were talking kind of about Andrew's interest in film as well. Anyway, you say what you were doing.
Sure. I mean, I had a slightly more circuitous route. I did modern languages in college and loved cinema, but didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I thought I would train as an accountant to have some sort of professional background. But in the meantime, the moment that lit my fuse, if you like, was a Christopher Shepherd talk in the IFI. He produced Orlando and talking about making that film and listening to him talk, you know, describe the challenges of making the film and how they raised the finance. I was like, wow, that's an incredible job. I never knew you could do that. And that was really, for me, the start. And then, as Ed says, we end up working together. I was a production accountant at that stage, and we did a film together. We started a conversation about how maybe by combining our backgrounds and resources, we could perhaps try and build a company of scale. So that was the start of it.
So it's kind of both of you have an interest in film. You've got the sort of accountant style background. How do you actually get the money? Like, I mean, especially in the start, because I mean, now you've got some, you know, really great relationships. And I imagine it's difficult, but in a way easier. Like, how do you do that from the start? I mean, like, trying to make your first...
You just beg, borrow, and steal. And actually, in a way, you know, I mean, I know it sounds like an old person now, but it's so easy to make something now on an iPhone. And it's, you know, and again, back to the Molly Manning Walker, you know, something just with friends in a living room. Actually, if that's good enough, that's all you need to do to get started. And you can do that for, like, if you just buy everyone a pint at the end of the day.
So let's just talk about making those kind of first features and maybe sort of the introduction of working with larger cast and how you made that step from these kind of smaller scale films, you know, up to that intermediate gap of where you're, you know, you're working with the bigger names.
I mean, I think partly it's our specific experience and it's not necessarily applicable now, but back, we set up the company in 2001 and by dint of being an Irish company, we had to kind of get out there and co-produce as much as we could. So you go to Europe and you'd find projects that we could then bring an Irish dimension to. And so we did a lot of co-production in the early years. Our first production that we worked on together was Peter Mullen's Magdalene Sisters, and we were the Irish co-producers on that film. And I guess, you know, so it was just by dint of
relationship building.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of relationship building. So, you know, and another early success for us was The Wind Shakes the Barley. We ended up being with Killian and Rebecca and Ken's Irish co-producers on that. And that was our, you know, first proper experience of Cannes, and it won the Palme d'Or. And, you know, so that all really helped. And at the time, it was quite advantageous to shoot TV drama in Ireland, UK TV drama. That's no longer the case because of the tax credit here now, but it's time there was none. So we did a lot of that too. And that was all relationship building as well. And on the back of that, we end up doing OMA, which I had produced with Paul Greengrass. And so all of these things contributed.
Hundreds of different things that you're
lots
doing
of chipping
over
away
period
at lots
of time
of things. Yeah,
rather
exactly.
Than one great, okay, well,
exactly.
Here's the money person. Yeah. It's actually a...
Yeah, and like, you know, the retrospective rationalization is a term I've picked up and like, and when you hear people spouting about how they plan to do something and off they went and did it, and often people do that, you know, so in hindsight they kind of put this narrative together. But I think we always had a bit of a sense of where we wanted to get to, but a lot of it was just plugging away and trying lots of things, and by the way, many a turkey in along the way too. So there were quite a few things we tried just didn't work and, you know, don't get talked about today, but they, you know, but we learned from that. And and I think, you know, ultimately at the end of that whole process, what we really understood, obvious as it might be, is that focusing on talent rather than chasing the market was the answer, at least for us.
Because if you develop something, then by the time it's actually developed, the market and the appetites have changed anyway.
Exactly.
So just lastly, if we could just get a bit of advice, maybe, you know, because of what you do, someone trying to make their first feature drama, they haven't necessarily got access to a huge infrastructure of, you know, top end cast or whatever. What's the advice, or, you know, or maybe something that you hadn't, you'd wish you'd known sort of starting out in the industry?
I mean, I think partly like we've been saying it, which is, you know, it's to make things, which is, you know, sort of obvious in one way, but like a lot of people spend a lot of time with a script that isn't getting much traction that they think they need 2 million quid for. And they just can't make it until they get 2 million quid. And that just means they're never going to make it. So it's just finding a way of actually getting stuff made. But also, as Andrew was saying earlier, it's also kind of having your peer group, you know, I mean, having people that you, again, I see it with, you know, Molly, just to talk about her, you know, she, you know, she's a DP as well and was before she started directing herself. But she, there's a whole gang of contemporaries there who help each other out. They work with each other. It's kind of finding those like-minded people. Yeah. And just having that as like both as kind of sort of as inspiration, in sources of inspiration, but also when, as it is a really hard business, but also to be able to go and kind of
support network in a way.
Yeah. And to kind of cry on someone's shoulder and, you know,
lots of crying going on.
Yeah. And it is that, and just trying to figure it out. But I think just making things and also maybe, you know, maybe you aren't as good as you think you are, and it's better to find that out and maybe do something else adjacent to what you thought you might want to do. In other words, if you want to produce and you find that you cannot organize anything, then you probably want to think about doing something else. So,
yeah. Well, thank you very much to both of you. It's been a fantastic insightful interview, and best of luck with Poor Things.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks. So that was Poor Things. What a brilliant chat with Ed Guiney and Andrew Lowe. If you haven't been, if you've been living under a rock, you may have noticed that Emma Stone picked up the Academy Award for her role in this very film.
If you haven't seen it already, go check out Poor Things in cinema.
Who have we got coming up next, Tobias?
Beekeeper,
that's true. We also have a very exciting Hollywood actor, which we're not going to spoil the surprise of yet.
But he starred in...
Steven Spielberg releases, Terrence Malick, and Jeff Nichols films. See if you can figure it out ahead of the episode. And who else have we got coming up? Who's the one? I don't know. Maybe it was just that one.
Brilliant. Yeah, the podcast will end in 2 episodes. There are no more guests coming up.
Yeah.
Final 2 episodes coming up.
You heard it here first. Yeah, that's what happens when Giles goes away. Yes, lastly, I can't remember. I think I mentioned this on another episode, but I thought it was a fun fact and I'd like to give it a shout out. So Ed Guiney, who I spoke to briefly after the interview, and he sort of said, oh, what do you do? Okay, I'm a filmmaker. He's like, oh, what's your last film? I said, Winter Ridge. And he's like, oh, I've seen that. So there we go. Ed Guiney of Element Pictures has seen my last film. A nice note to end on.
That's very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially as the podcast is ending in 2 episodes. Good. Okay. Good night, everyone. Good night.
What? No, wait. We have to include the elevator.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We've got to do something with the elevator, haven't we?
Build an elevator and...
Send it back down for new filmmakers. I think that was that's the slogan. We might have got it wrong.
Have a lovely week. Bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye.